The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
I'm Scott Wapner, and you're listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast, the most profitable hour of the trading day. We record this live weekdays at 12 Eastern. Listen in.
All right, welcome to the Halftime Report. I'm Scott Wapner. Front and center this hour, the turbulent week for investors, what it might say about the future of this rally. We'll ask the investment committee and get their best ideas right now. Joining me for the hour today, everybody's here at Post 9. Josh Brown, Shannon Sekosha, Jason Snipe, Rich Saperstein. Let's check the markets. S&P's going positive. The Nasdaq's positive, as you see. Dow's a touch negative, but you did have a cooler PPI today, and that follows that CPI, which certainly frayed a lot of nerves yesterday. And Josh, you told me yesterday afternoon you still think that this is a market to buy, not a market to sell.
Yeah, and to recap, one of the things I was looking for on CPI was a buyable sell-off. I had hoped that it would have gotten worse. We just, I never get enough time to panic these days, I guess, is the problem.
100%.
There's just the kids, the job, there's just not enough. Anyway, I didn't buy anything yesterday, I should have. But I thought that yesterday was a counter-trend move, Judge. That's the term that I used. The predominant trend is an uptrend. It's not my opinion. That's data. Sorry. I think it stays intact. If it changes, I'll be the first person to tell you, hey, the trend is lower. It isn't. And I don't think the bank earnings we see at the end of this week are going to be the catalyst to change that direction. I just don't see it. These are companies that are nominally earning tons of money because of where rates are, especially relative to years past. That ain't going to change. Capital markets, not great, but good enough. And then if you look at the lending business, the demand is there and business is getting done. So when you consider NIM and you consider the various factors that are going to impact the earnings we'll see from big banks, they are good to great. Then you look at the asset managers, BlackRock will report. That's not coming off of hard comps. The comps there are fairly easy. It's an asset manager with bond prices and stock prices rising. I think they'll do well. So I don't think the banks are going to give you the reason to sell. And absent that, the trend remains higher.
All right. So Rich Saperstein, you're getting a lot of Fed speak today around the inflation reports. And the most recent one is Collins right now. At noon. So a couple minutes ago, we can bring you these headlines now. Fed expects it's going to be appropriate to begin cutting later this year. Okay, more time's needed. That seems to be the party line at this point. Williams, who's a voter, said rate cuts starting this year. No need to adjust in the, quote, very near term. He does expect PCE inflation to be 2.25 to 2.5 this year, moving closer to 2% next year. So the idea that you're still getting cuts this year is not off the table. And I wonder if that's at the heart of why the bulls are still bullish, because at the end of the day, that's all that matters.
Look, there's two types of tightening. There's the tightening like occurred in 99 with Greenspan, where it was preemptive, trying to slow a heating economy. And there's the slam the brakes, which the Fed did to really control inflation. And that's a trickier tightening. So inflation has come down, but it doesn't have a two handle. It's likely not getting there so quickly. But the important point as an investor is to buy stocks irrespective of what the Fed's doing and whether they're going to tighten or not. So maybe they'll tighten two more times this year, two times.
Tighten?
Loosen the second half of the year, okay? Maybe not. But the point is to identify names that are generating free cash flows that are going to do well in an environment irrespective of a Fed.
Okay, so you've been pretty negative, the market, for a long time, right? Are you still today? You're not. Are you more? So let me ask you this. Why don't you characterize your own level of constructiveness, if you want to put it that way, mm-hmm. from somebody who was decidedly negative for many, many, many months going back a year, it feels like, right? I think that's a fair assessment of your view of the market. So you tell us today where you're at.
So we, let's call it 18, 20 months ago, raised cash and bought municipal bonds at 4% plus yields. Mm-hmm. So we reduced our client equity exposure down, but we captured an opportunity that hasn't come back yet. So we were cautious, created the cash, and then invested in munis. We're fully invested today. And we think the economy is strong. If you look at wealth in America at $155 trillion, ISMs in manufacturing has strengthened. We've got 26 months of unemployment below 4%. That's the first time since 1947. So anywhere you look, the economy is doing well. So we're fully invested. The question really is, are we hanging on to every move of the Fed mm-hmm. to get a market higher? No, at this point, it is earnings. We haven't had earnings growth in 2 years. So 23 and 22, the S&P generated 220 in earnings. This year, it has to move higher in order for the market to move higher.
Okay. What's clear to me is like many, not singling you out, obviously, is that you underestimated the durability of the economy. You expected things to happen that haven't happened, and now you don't think are gonna happen. Is that
Correct.
Fair?
That's fair, yet we didn't feel we were giving anything up by adding tax-free municipal bonds at 4% plus.
Of course.
Which we're happy to have right now.
But when you say you're fully invested, what does that fully invested breakdown look like? What part of your fully invested is in equities?
Yeah, so if we had a client with 50% equities, took the client down to 45%, added 5% to the fixed income side, now that 45% is back up to 50%. So we're back to par in our asset allocations. So client asset allocations are running anywhere from, let's call it 20 to 40% on the fixed income side and 40 to 60% on the equity side.
Okay. I mean, I ask you all these questions because you're one of the highest rated financial advisors in America, and presumably, you know, people who watch you on our program, they want to know what kind of breakdowns you have.
Yeah.
You know, they're asking their own financial advisors these similar kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm.
As Shannon, the bulls still feel emboldened. They're not willing to give up the ship just yet, because ultimately they think that the economy is going to remain strong and the Fed's going to cut. And they may cut in July and they may cut later than we thought, but we don't need the cuts now anyway, so it's no big whoop if we have to wait.
So that last point that you just made is the most important point. If you look at the bull story for the equity market, for commodities, for not just here in the U.S., ex-U.S. Stocks, you think about, you know, the difference in the U.S. economy versus outside of the U.S. And the reality is the difference is that we have been able to digest this higher rate scenario better than anticipated, both on the consumer side and on the corporate side. So if you look at what the Fed is looking at, they're saying, okay, we have the lever to be able to cut rates. We can do that because we've got a spread between, you know, and by the way, PCE is going to be, you know, in the twos, right? That's what the Fed looks at, not CPI. So PCE in the twos, they have the opportunity to cut rates, but they don't need to. And because they're looking at the economic data that we're all looking at and saying, yeah, there are pockets of weakness, lower income consumers. But the reality is for the bulls to change their mind, they need to have evidence that the Fed is going to have to cut because the economy is deteriorating. And we're just not seeing that. We're actually seeing, Scott, a reacceleration in manufacturing. We've been in a manufacturing recession. It's an expansion. So that's why the bulls are emboldened.
All right. So Jason Stipe, Krinsky over at BTIG says it's too early to buy. Citi says it's too early to bail. I'm simplifying both. In some respects, but that's the headline of my takeaway. Too early to buy versus too early to bail.
Yeah.
You want to weigh in on that?
So for me, I take a lot of what Shannon just said. I mean, PMIs are rebounding, services are strong, labor is strong, you know, the economy is strong. And to Rich's point as well, I mean, earnings, we've been in an earnings recession for the last 2 years. Obviously, earnings have strengthened, and we're expecting, again, they've been revised down from 10% to 5%, but we're expecting earnings to carry us through the rest of the year. Margins are expanding as well. So for me, I do not think it's early to buy or too late to sell. I think this is an opportunity for all market participants to get in and stay in, right? And I think that the market is going to give you more opportunities through the rest of the year.
So let's play the what if game, because that's, you know, what the, you know, the bears are going to say, well, what if inflation proves, Rich, too sticky for any rate cuts this year? Okay, that's number one. Well, what if the economy ultimately buckles under higher for longer as the Fed waits and pushes cuts out maybe another 30 days from what we thought into the summer? Is the market adequately thinking about that or too complacent about either of those scenarios?
Well, it leads to the question of whether 21 and a half times earnings is the new 16 times earnings. And a lot of that has to do with a third of the S&P and large cap tech. But the market's been fueled by AI tailwinds, the prospect of declining inflation, as well as Fed cuts. You now start moving the Fed cuts later or off the table, the market has to see earnings improvement to move higher from here.
Which is expected.
It is. So investors should hold on to their positions, but I think we've got to move the ball from the Fed's playing field into where is their value in the market in an environment where the Fed doesn't cut at all.
Well, okay, so where is that value? Because I think the broadening trade had gotten legs on the idea of cuts, right?
Yeah.
You were seeing cyclical areas of the economy and of the market be bought on the idea, well, the economy's going to remain strong and the Fed's going to cut. So if I take cuts off the table, or at least I push them back, do I need to rethink the broadening trade itself?
I think there's a couple of sectors that will continue to do well. And we're overweight large cap tech and oil. We have been for a long time. And these are generating recurring cash flows, and they're returning the capital to shareholders. I think the broadening trade could occur, yet we're remaining focused on those two sectors right now with our overweight position.
So, I mean, your energy call has been spot on. It's, you know, it's up 13%. The sector is since March 1st. We all know what it's been doing. Josh, you've been talking about it a lot. Materials, utilities, other areas, financials. You talked about at the top of the show. We're going to get some, you know, real world view and earnings in the morning for some of these names. Do we need to think the broadening trade if we are pushing out rate cuts?
No, I don't think we do. It's a good question. Like, is the reason we've had a broadening out of the market, is it predicated on people sensing that the Fed easing is coming closer and closer? Perhaps in some areas you could say yes, certainly with smaller capitalization companies. But I want to build on something that Rich said, because I think it's really important. You mentioned there being three primary tailwinds that the market has enjoyed, and I agree with all three of those.
Mm-hmm.
The prospect of Fed rate cuts. I would argue the prospect is better than the cuts themselves. All right, so that's one.
Right.
Two, disinflation. Okay, it's not as great as it was 6 months ago, but we're sort of still on the right track. It's a little bit of a hiccup right now. And I forget what the first one was, but I agree with that also.
AI.
Fine, great. Let me add more. Let me add some more. Because these ain't going away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Almost regardless of what the Fed does.
GOP?
Well, first.
I'm not kidding. I think people say that's one of the bullish things in the market, too, along with AI. GLP-1, the trend there. But anyway, I digress. You go ahead.
No, I agree. There's a bull market in obese people. 100%. 100%.
Really?
Yes. But what I would add, and not that, is we just have a shortage of equity. And the FT did a piece on this a couple of days ago, and everyone on Wall Street read it. It is undeniable that every year, due to buybacks globally, we remove $1.2 trillion worth of stocks from the markets that can be bought by investors. It's a fact, and it's not going to change. And in fact, this year, it will go higher, both in the U.S., but now abroad, as country after country look at the U.S. model and they say, actually, you know how you fix your economy? fix your capital markets first. China's doing it. Japan is doing it. Larry Fink just dedicated his entire Dear Shareholder letter to 17 countries around the world engaging in this idea. Hey, let's do what America did. Let's get the stock market fixed. So that's taking place, and that will involve more and more buybacks, which means less and less places for money to go. You got private equity sitting on, what is it, $2 trillion in dry powder?
Lots.
That's more companies leaving the market. There were 3,000-something stocks. When I started in this business, there were 7,000. Now, most of those missing stocks are penny stocks, so throw that out. But still, the Wilshire 5,000 can't even muster an index. There's not enough public equities to fill it.
Yeah.
So that is a dynamic. And so when people say, oh, in my day, the baseline PE ratio was 16, it ain't your day, player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's my day. And in my day, valuations are systemically higher because people need to invest.
So do you see any tail risk events out there?
Of course, there always will be.
Like?
When won't there be?
Like?
Well, the Middle East doesn't seem too cool right now.
Okay, geopolitical. Sure,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oil price spike, that wouldn't be great except for you and I because we're overweight.
But no, but to his point, though, those always exist. Are you going to take on less risk in the equity market because you're worried about geopolitics?
No, but that's why you own oil as a hedge.
I'm with you on that.
Okay, mm-hmm. But there's also one that's going on under the hood, which is Washington's running a $2 trillion deficit. They've got to issue $10 trillion worth of bonds this year.
Understood.
Okay.
Been hearing that for a year.
Yeah, but at some point, there's a hibernating animal that used to come out in the 80s that's been hibernating now for 40 years. It's called the vigilante of the bond market. And that could occur this year.
It's a myth. The Japanese have been looking for that vigilante for four decades.
Well, they're net sellers.
It's like Sasquatch.
China's net sellers, okay? Mm-hmm. The Fed, they might curtail QT, okay, but if you look at a tail risk event that's not being priced in, that's one. It's not changing what I'm doing. We're shortening our maturities on the debt side as a result of that in our bond portfolios, as that is a risk that's possible.
Let me ask you another question. So if you're at 50% exposure into equities, yeah, right, what are you traditionally, like historically, what's your number? If you're managing wealth for an extraordinarily, you know, high net worth cohort,
mm-hmm,
you may never be more than 50%. You're mm-hmm trying to preserve wealth, not create necessarily more at a time where you're taking on excess risk, correct?
Exactly.
Okay, so what historically are you?
So typically the clients give us, we have one directive, which is the return of capital is more important than the return on capital.
My point exactly.
So our equity allocations for those clients have gotten as high as 60%. Currently, let's call it 50% with 30-40% in bonds and 10-15% in less market correlated investments. So at 50%, you know, if we've got 4% tax free on a muni bond, that's 8% pre-tax, and we have a target rate of return of 5-7% a year, what do I need to squeeze out of the balance now that I have a base of 4% tax free?
Of course. Well, again, return of in your world is more important than return on.
Exactly.
People have different objectives based on the level of wealth that mm-hmm they're managing for people.
Exactly.
So historically, you are now where you traditionally have been.
Exactly.
How do you assess what the proper mix is in this kind of market?
So I think the thing to think about is that prior to, you know, prior to 2020, the challenge was is that you had to take increasing levels of equity risk because the bond market didn't pay anything. So we had a decade where you couldn't count on that income component of your return, and therefore you had to take on either lower quality credits that yielded better returns, or you had to add more equity. And so I think one of the challenges right now is I think that there's a perception that all of these investors will go back and anchor themselves to like a 2005 portfolio when there was actually bond yields. And mm-hmm and I think the challenge is now is that people have been building wealth based on equities for 15 years now. And I think it's going to be difficult to re-anchor those investors to say, listen, we're going to cut meaningfully your equity exposure because you can get the yield in the other part of your portfolio. We also, Scott, there's inflation. whether it's 2 or it's 3, or we didn't have that. We were deflationary prior to the pandemic. So now you actually have to kind of balance out, do you need your capital to continue to grow in excess of inflation? And so the mix is, it's not going back to 2005, in my view. I think there's still going to be a bias towards a slightly higher equity mix than you've had historically, because people are looking at that as a real way to grow their wealth over time and preserve it, because the equities are upwardly sloping.
All right, let's go granular for a minute before we take our first break. In terms of places you want to be, stocks you might want to trim, it leads me, Jason, to you with this NVIDIA move that you've trimmed. So, you know, you join a group of people on this show who over time have trimmed this name. Now, it was in a, you know, 10% drawdown.
Which means nothing.
Of late. And it has been snapped up, including today, by the way, with NVIDIA shares up 2.3%. So why'd you trim it now? As the price target, by the way, goes to $1,110 from $850 at Raymond James today.
Yeah, so, I mean, Scott, you know it. We talk about it a lot. Stock's up close to 80% year-to-date. You know, so for us, it's above our benchmark, you know, where we are in our growth portfolio. So, and we've trimmed it several times throughout, especially over the last 2 years. And for us here, you know, this is not an indictment on the stock. It's not a reaction to what we hear from Intel or other players that are looking, that are producing chips maybe at a cheaper price. That's not the deal at all. This is portfolio management. As boring as it might sound, it is something that we need to do. The GTC conference was very impressive. All the partnerships that they've discussed. I think even what's going on with their inference microservices and what they're able to deliver for developers for GPU chips, I think it's just expanding the TAM even more. But again, we wanted to take a little bit off the table and look elsewhere for opportunity.
All right, let's talk about Amazon too. It's higher today. Right now, it is above a new record closing high. 187.77, thereabout. You see it, there it is, exactly on that number. The intraday high is 188.65, Josh. So we've got some new air here. For shares of Amazon.
Look, this was the large cap tech name that I thought would be the best performer of the year. And so far I'm right. It's, you know, we got a long time to go. But the reason that I felt that way was really that expectations had been fairly tame versus the Apples and the Microsofts of the world. That's a really great ingredient to start with. That's when you want to take a second look at stocks, when the street is not looking for huge leaps and bounds. The hurdle was lower for them to leap over. They're very involved in AI, like extraordinarily so. There is no AI if Amazon Web Services is not delivering, quite frankly, most of it. People forget. The question is like, well, where is all the money going to be made? It's not just going to be in semis. In fact, the semi play of ultimately is going to get brutal. The platform play is better, less potential competitors, more lock-in, customer lock-in. You think the typical customer cares if they're running a GPU from company A versus company B 3 years from now? No. What they're going to care about are the services built onto their AI platform. And that's where Amazon really has potential. Stock is 26% above its 200-day moving average. The RSI is 68. It might not be like the best possible day to buy it, but I will stay long here, and I would not be afraid to get long this stock. It's been above its 200-day for about 233 trading days. So the trend is solid, and I think there'll be opportunities on the way up. But I'm long, and I'm really pleased with what I'm seeing here so far.
Rich, you're long the name as well, as it gets reiterated as a top large cap pick at Evercore ISI. That's by Mark Mahaney. He says that he sees Amazon as one of the few large caps with material multiple re-rating potential this year.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with the dynamic of changing their cost structure, which is a large catalyst, and it's moving their cash flow likely from $32 billion in 2023 to $82 billion in 2024. So all the reasons that Josh mentioned and, you know, the analysts on the street are out there, but there's also that dynamic in the cash flow.
Jason, you want to take Alphabet too? Because Mahaney also loves that name. Tactical outperform. We view the short-term risk-reward outlook here as attractive, believe street top and bottom line estimates are reasonably set up. Our channel checks have been consistently constructive. That's a direct quote from Mahaney in the note today.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, for Google, we were talking a few months ago about the AI rollout that just didn't go so well, right? But what I will say about Google, even if you flow back to the last report, I mean, operational margins grew 30%+. Revenue growth was up 15%. It's trading at 23 times. And the stock has performed better than a lot of the other major names, you know, that we talk about all the time. But they're also announced a partnership with Apple that I think could be very profitable for them going forward. So I like where they are from an innovation perspective and what they've done cost control.
Rich, you want to give me 20 seconds on Microsoft? Target goes to 520 today from 465, and that's at Morgan Stanley.
Well, I think if investors are going to find certain companies that they want to own in that AI space, and, you know, embedded in there, it has to be Microsoft. So it's not a cheap stock, but great companies are not cheap. And, you know, recurring revenues, a lot of cash flow, it's cloud. There's a lot of reasons to own that name.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to trade the financials because they are on deck for earnings starting tomorrow. By the way, the worst sector this week. The ETF that tracks that space, the XLF, is below its 50-day moving average for the first time since November. We have a lot to talk about. We have a lot to trade between that and a lot more when we come back after this.
Are you following the Halftime Report podcast? What are you waiting for? Look for us in your favorite podcasting app. Follow the Halftime Podcast now.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
B2B selling is tougher than ever, and we feel your pain. If you're struggling to close deals, consider giving LinkedIn Sales Navigator a shot. This sales intelligence platform helps professionals like you engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator also guides you in targeting the right buyers, highlights key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and uncovers hidden hot prospects so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/halftimereport. That is linkedin.com/halftimereport for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/halftimereport and get started.
All right, welcome back. Let's talk about the banks because they do kick off earnings season officially, Shan, tomorrow. I mentioned some of the damage in that space. Month to date, the stocks have all not performed very well. This sector was one of the better ones over the last, 5 weeks. Have things turned because of rates?
I mean, I think there's some concerns around that. I mean, if you look at the banks, they're, you know, they have been beset by continuing increasing provisions for credit losses, slow loan growth that Josh talked about earlier. And there has been an expectation that, and there's been a wide divergence, right, between the big banks and the regionals. And obviously that's been in place since early 2023 with everything we've seen in the regional banks. But I think that you're also, this is a second half story, Scott. And so, but to put it on, put a point on it, estimates have already been revised down for the big banks for 2024 by 10%, for the regionals by almost 25%. So you're not coming into this with these really constructive viewpoints on banks for earnings this year. And so while this near-term overhang from this, you know, changing rate environment, whether mm-hmm. it's June, July, or September, there's some of that has already been priced in just from the low expectations that are being set. What you could see coming up over the next few days is that you could see no major credit surprises. You could see, you know, maybe like modestly increasing loan growth. And for the big banks, you've got investment banking and wealth management certainly are going to look better in the second half.
If we're focusing on the biggest banks, why do you think it's a second half story?
Because I think that they are expecting that they will get that rate lift from a net interest income perspective in the second half of the year. And so they're going to guide for better results in their true banking segment in the second half of the year. Also, there's an anticipation that capital market activity is also going to pick up in the second half of the year based on the fact that we're seeing, you know, a foundationally stronger environment for equity issuance.
Rich, so if I own the JPMs, Goldman's, and Bank of America's, as you do, how am I supposed to feel about this space today as it's suffered, as I said, some, you know, technical damage below its 50-day for the first time, the XLF is since November, but also some questions now. If rates are going to remain higher for longer, delinquencies go up, charge-offs, all that kind of stuff to be concerned about, do I need to rethink the financials trade?
Well, years ago, when Reagan was president, you know, you used to be able to buy this industry below book value, and you sold it at 1.5, 2 times book value. Today, Bank of America is 1.5 times book. JP's 2.2 times book. Their return on capital is 11-12%. So they're doing well. They're expensive. But keep in mind, Bank of America had $130 billion of unrealized losses on their balance sheet and their hold-to-maturity portfolio. That's now down to $100 billion. So would I be adding them here? Probably not. Are we holding them? Yes, we are.
You in that camp? I mean, you love JP Morgan better than all of those banks because that's the one I think that you own, the only one, right?
I don't feel the need to own the group broadly. If they work, JP Morgan will be among the better performers. And if they don't work, well, then I don't have to wake up and be like, oh my God, do I literally own Wells Fargo? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have to have that. I don't have to have that conversation with myself. So that's where I am. Look, JP Morgan is going to do $4.15 a share, according to consensus. That's not a huge jump over the prior year, but it ain't nothing either. Quarterly revenue, $41.96 billion and that's versus $39 billion in the year-ago quarter. So I mentioned nominal growth that we would see from the banks. That's what I mean. It's not like all of a sudden banking is an amazing business. It's just that it was so bad in 22 and coming out of that in 23, and now you've got a better environment overall. JP Morgan trades at a premium, which Rich mentions, but I would argue with good damn reason, 22% CAGR on earnings per share growth in the last 3 years. None of the other names can say that. 13% over the last 5 years, so that's not just a recent phenomenon. I expect JP Morgan to have a good quarter. I remain long the stock. I think it's worth more than $200 a share. I like the fact that it's down, a little bit of a gift here.
All right. I should remind all of you, too, BlackRock reports tomorrow, and the chairman and CEO, Larry Fink, is going to visit with Squawk on the Street tomorrow. Don't miss that. It's first on CNBC, and it's always interesting to hear from Larry Fink on our network right after their earnings are released as well about that and the greater sort of investing environment. Let's get the headlines now with Dom Chu. Hey, Dom.
All right, Judge. A judge ruled today that New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez and his wife, Nadine Menendez, will actually stand trial separately for their bribery case. That judge made the ruling due in part to Nadine Menendez's health and that she would need to find new lawyers within 30 days as her current team would have to step aside due to conflicts of interest. Senator Menendez is scheduled to stand trial on May 8th. Well, USAID USAID Administrator Samantha Power said it was credible to assess that famine is already happening in Gaza. She noted at a congressional hearing that prior to October 7th, the rate of malnutrition was nearly zero, but now it was 1 in 3 children. Power's response makes her the first official to publicly agree that famine was already happening in that war-torn region. And crews are working quickly to patch a 60-foot crack in a Utah dam that could endanger a town nearby. While state and local officials believe the dam is not in danger of breaking, they have warned the 1,800 residents in a nearby town to be ready to evacuate if those conditions do worsen. Some stunning video over there. Judge, I'll send things back over to you.
All right, I appreciate that, Dom. Thanks, Dom Chu. Up next, we'll do our calls of the day. We got trades on Costco and Chevron, Amex, and more in 2 minutes.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, Our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
We're back. We're going to do some calls of the day now, and we're going to start with Chevron. Take a look at shares, because the target was raised today to 195 from 170 at Scotiabank, upgraded to sector perform, from sector perform. Rich, you own it. As you said at the top of the program, you are way overweight oil. Why this name specifically? Well, you have Exxon, too, I should say.
And Canadian Natural Resources.
Okay.
We're overweight oil, and generally it's geopolitical hedge. Their earnings contribution to the S&P is going to be 10%, yet their market cap exposure of the S&P is only 5%. But with regard to Chevron and Exxon, we're talking about companies that have gotten discipline in their CapEx. So they're generating now roughly 12, 13% operating cash flow, free cash flow 7, 8%. What are they going to do with it? They can dividend out, buy back stock. So in an environment where you have an uncertain Fed, and you want a geopolitical hedge, Chevron, Exxon, all these names are great, great adds to a portfolio.
All right, let's take a look at shares of Qualcomm, too, today, because they were added to the negative catalyst watch at J.P. Morgan. Jason Snipe, this is going to be yours. Price target's 170, so a couple bucks below where it is now. They still have it rated overweight. However, they say we are yet to see any significant change in the fundamentals for the smartphone market, with the recovery expected to remain muted in 2024.
Yeah. So, you know, I will say this about Costco. Qualcomm. I mean, for me, you know, the stock is up 18% year to date. The multiple has been driven up some, right? So it's trading at 17 times now. Android has recovered. So automotive as well has been driving growth for the company. So, and I think they have a solid IP and silicone business. So, and IoT has been a little bit soft in the last quarter, but I think that, you know, with the multiple expanding some, there is probably, you know, in somewhat of a limited growth rate of 11%. I think that's where a little bit of the concern is.
All right, you said, you accidentally said Costco, so I'm going to give you that one now, okay? Because you have that, and it was reiterated as equal weight at Wells. The stock's obviously done well.
Yeah.
They just say it's too expensive for us right now.
Yeah, I mean, the multiple has expanded quite a bit. I mean, the price action has been really solid over the last year and a half. There's been some softness in discretionary spend, and I think that's what's been a little bit challenging for them going forward. But essentials have been good. Kirkland's been really strong. The multiple is a concern, but I think that, you know, in a market that we're in, Costco is the best retailer in that space.
All right, Josh, you flagged NASDAQ for our viewers days ago. Well, Barclays does today. They initiated overweight, price target 76. That's about 20% upside from here. Clear path to double-digit EPS growth is what they see.
Yeah, and that's a couple of days after Morgan Stanley said it's a top pick with an $80 target. I think ultimately, as an investment, the stock works its way higher because there's a lot of scarcity value here. There just aren't that many versions of what NASDAQ is and does. Of course, we're sitting here at their largest competitor, but NASDAQ's got exchanges all over the world. And as I mentioned 2 days ago, they've also been diversifying. So it's not just markets related revenue. They've been acquiring software businesses. There's a very healthy portfolio there of ARR type businesses, which is what Wall Street loves. The annually recurring revenue model, yep, coupled with, I think, a significantly stronger IPO market in the market side in the second half of this year, I think you've got a double-barreled shotgun approach, and I think the stock works its way at least to 76. So I am long, I like the technicals, and I like the fundamentals.
Jason, go quick on Amex, because Deutsche says it's a good place to hide. Those were their words. Safest placed among the card issuers.
Yeah, so I really like the consumer that they obviously focus on. You know, credit quality is strong. Amex plays well in that space. And I think for me, you know, as I look forward and I look at the quality of the consumer and where business travel is starting to grow, I think Amex is our favorite
spot. All right. So good day to hear from Mike Santoli. Obviously, every day really is, but especially today, given this second inflation print, a lot of Fed speak, markets acting interesting today, too. So we'll talk to him next. A news alert on OpenAI's Sam Altman. I want to get to Steve Kovac. So he was on Capitol Hill and our cameras were there too.
Yeah, that's right, Scott. He was coming out of Senator Todd Young's office just now. He was Senator Todd Young. He's a member of an AI task force that was appointed by Senator Chuck Schumer. And this is coming after Sam Altman spent the last few days in the Middle East talking to potential investors and government leaders about raising money and plans for his grand ambition to create this whole chip network, so to speak, for artificial intelligence. Our Karen James Sloan, she was there on the ground as he came out of the senator's office. Here's what he said about that trip.
How are you?
Tell me how your meeting went.
I think it was great.
What did you say to Todd Young?
We talked about the need for the U.S. to have like a general policy about AI leadership in the world and make sure that we're able to deliver all the benefits of these services.
Did you talk about your chip? Did you talk about AI chips and whether the United States is going to approve
chips,
it?
Energy, the whole package of what it takes to be able to deliver AI.
Tell me what you said to leaders in the Middle East about AI chip funding.
It wasn't just about AI chip. Funding is obviously part of it, but there's like a very complex supply chain. There's a thing that we'll need to figure out about how we're going to do security and policy for this. So it was a conversation like we've had in many other countries around the world about what it takes to do this as a global effort.
What about here in the Senate right now? They're trying to get through some kind of AI policy, but do you feel it's taking too long? And what should be the priority?
Well, that's one thing we're asking is like, what are they thinking about what the priorities should be? There's obviously a lot to do. It's a complex thing. So what we've been, you know, asking for updates on that in meetings. I don't think we have a view yet on when it'll happen, exactly what it'll look like.
Have they given you any updates?
Obviously they don't say like it'll happen like exactly this on this time.
So Scott Altman there talking about his trip to the Middle East. And you might remember a few weeks ago, we got that headline, that report saying he was looking to raise trillions of dollars for whatever these ambitions are to make artificial intelligence more powerful and capable. But like he just told our Karen there, Karen James Sloan there, he also said it's about more than that. Enormous amounts of energy is going to be required to run these data centers and really achieve the vision he's thinking of. And then on the legislation front or the regulatory front, also talking about meeting with lawmakers there. As we know, he was on Capitol Hill about a year ago talking about what his view for AI regulation should look like. Nothing has happened from then. And also our Congress has been really slow to act on, you know, previous generations of technology like social media and so forth. So not a lot of regulatory action going on there. Though I will mention Democrat Adam Schiff, who's running for Senate in California, he's in Congress now, did put out a bill yesterday saying that these companies should disclose if they're training their AI models on copyrighted data. But some interesting stuff there from Sam Altman about what he's talking to leaders around the world about, Scott.
I appreciate that. Steve Kovac, thank you very much. Sure. Nice job from our D.C. Bureau as well to get that exclusive video and sound from Sam Altman on the Hill. All right, Mike Santoli, he's next with his Midday Word. Senior markets commentator Mike Santoli joins us with his Midday Words. Good to see you as always. So yesterday we were down and out, and today we're back. Yeah, back to a degree, Scott. And also, you know, yesterday, down and out for sure, but it was relatively contained. I think that you got into this position where the rise in longer-term bond yield just throttles market breadth, right? So the internals of the market look pretty weak yesterday. They don't look great today, but there's not a ton of motivated selling across the big caps in the index because we are going to get earnings coming through. And the other thing about PPI today, to the extent you want to extrapolate it out into the PCE inflation number in a couple of weeks, it should come in not that far from expectations, which itself is not that far from where, you know, the median Fed official says that core PCE should be at the end of the year to accommodate at least some easing. So I don't think that the story was entirely upended, even though we had a market coming into April that probably was going to be needing to back off a little bit and cool itself. And you know, maybe it's broken some momentum in the short term.
Yeah, and undoubtedly, I guess, a sigh of relief in some respects from the bulls. I'll see you on closing bell. I look forward to our conversation then. That's Mike Santoli, our senior markets commentator. We're going to do final trades next. Plus, we have a new buy from Rich Saperstein. We'll detail that coming up, too. All right, welcome back. I teased a move that our Rich Saperstein has made in the market. You bought Fidelity National, FIS. Why?
It's a $40 billion software provider to the financial services industry, 2% dividend yield. But 80% of their revenue is recurring. They're growing at 6%. They have a 9% operating cash flow. So you take out the dividend, they have some capex, and they're going to start doing some very significant buybacks.
All right. How recently was the buy made?
Still buying it.
Are you still buying it? Okay. Appreciate you mentioning it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me remind you what's coming up on Closing Bell as well today. We have Cameron Dawson with me, Joe Terranova. We have the former Dallas Fed president, Robert Kaplan. Also just added an interview with the Wall Street Journal's Nick Timiraos on what the Fed's going to do next. So I hope you'll join me at 3 o'clock Eastern time as we catch up on all things markets and I take you through the final stretch. Let's do some final trades. Shannon, why don't you start us off?
I'm going to talk about commodities. This is my contrarian trade of the year, and we're finally getting some steam behind it. So happy to see some motion in commodity prices.
All right, Jason Knight.
Chubb, a lot of excitement around insurance. Operating income was up 42% year over year. I like this one.
All right, Rich Saperstein.
Chevron, great returns of capital to shareholders and a geopolitical hedge, and I love the sector.
All right, obviously do. Way overweight energy, says Rich Saperstein. All right, Josh Brown.
Toast, not just because I love being asked to give someone a tip when they hand me a muffin, but because they have earnings coming up on May 7th, and I think we'll see a good quarter, so I'm long here.
All right, good stuff. I'll see you in a couple hours. The exchanges now.
You've been listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast. You can always catch us live weekdays at 12 Eastern, only on CNBC.
All opinions expressed by the Halftime Report participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company, or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Halftime Report participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Halftime Report disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/halftime-report-disclaimer.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.